Paul O'Sullivan, on a very big day. You've been investigating something for the last 6 years. The scoundrel, or one of the scoundrels in the middle of all of this, had to be extradited from the UK, brought back to South Africa. But what makes this story fascinating is this man was the chief executive of one of the biggest construction companies listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, a position that he held from 2001 to 2007. His name is Michael Lomas, and Paul O'Sullivan, you have brought this man to justice, or so it would appear. But perhaps let's go back. Mike Lomas was the chief executive of Group 5. He left in 2007. Group 5 had a good times after he left. We had the 2010 building boom. Then the collusion allegations came in 2013, and in fact, the company went bust 2019. How did he get involved with this company that was stealing so blatantly from Eskom?
Okay, so when he was the CEO of Group 5, he had to fall in line with their compulsory, you know, Group 5 were a public company. He had to fall in line with their compulsory retirement story. So he had to retire, I think, at the age of 64 or something like that, 65. So he had to go on pension. And here he was. Remember, he's British. He's from the UK. I think he's born and grew up in Manchester or somewhere up in the north of England. And he went to university in Manchester and studied engineering. So a very competent person, by the way. So what happened was, after he went on pension, he was still living in South Africa, himself and his wife. And I guess he felt he had more work left in him and he wanted to contribute more to the economy. And he had a reputation because everybody knew him. So he ended up being invited as a consultant to assist Trindade's group of companies, which was in a bit of a mess. The group of companies were a bit of a mess because they hadn't really got any good corporate governance in place, and they were making money so fast with their corrupt practices that actually they were disorganized. They didn't even have an asset register. They had nothing. So if there was a proper audit of the company, in fact, the auditors, I've got some of the audit reports, the auditors were screaming at them because they were auditing large. And they had to have clean audits because they were working for public companies like Eskom. So they had to have clean audits. And the auditors were screaming at them because they were failing to properly manage their affairs. So they brought Mike Lomas in to help them clean up their company, which I guess for the first 2 or 3 years, he probably did quite a good job. But then what happened one day... he met with this fellow, Klakudi, and Klakudi told him he needed money. So he went back to Trindade, and Trindade told him, okay, well, you pay him from your account, and I'll sort you out later. So that's how it began. So he made these payments, and I think we added it up. It was like 4 or 5 million rand over a period of a few months. But every time he made a payment, because we've got Mike Lomas's bank statements as well, because when I met with him, he gave me all of his bank statements. And in fact, the statements that he had missing, he gave me a special power of attorney, and we applied to the bank, and we got those bank statements from his bank. So we were able to fill in all the gaps. And every time he made a payment to Fakudi, there was a concomitant payment from Trindade's company, Tubular Steel or whatever they were called, into his own bank account. So what that did for us was prove that it wasn't Mike Lomas, although he was actually the bag man, if you like, but it proved that Mike Lomas's version was correct, which was he was instructed to pay and then claim the money back like an expense voucher from Trindade. So we then had Lomas, Trindade, Clacoody, and a couple of others in the bag. And we just had to literally sit and put it all together, which we did. And I think I opened the docket. I first, as I do in my normal manner, I wrote to Trindade, invited him to pay back the 1.4 billion rand that he'd stolen from Eskom. And he hired an attorney, a little fellow by the name of Robert Kanarak, who in turn hired, Lawrence Hodes. And they attacked me quite nicely. In fact, Lawrence Hodes failed miserably because he brought an urgent application in the court to try and get all the evidence that I had, and I told him to get lost. And when we went to court, he tried to bully me in the court, and I pointed out to the court that the documents he was asking for were in fact part of the docket against his client, and that if he wanted those, he would have to wait for his client to be arrested and charged, and then ask the state for those documents. And he made a big story about the fact that his client would never be arrested and charged. 6 weeks later, he was arrested and charged. So the court agreed with me that I didn't have to hand over the evidence, which is about 4,000 pages of documents. So the documents themselves are, in fact, handed over to the state. And certain aspects of it will form part of the prosecution of these people. And the evidence is watertight. I don't see how they can get away with it.
I've read your affidavits, and there's no doubt of the involvement of Mark Lomas as well with Tlakudi and getting him to do various things. But we won't go into the details. The question really is, what happens to Lomas now? He's arrived back in South Africa. He's had to be extradited from the UK, which I think would not make him very popular with the state here. Is it possible that he can become a state witness?
Well, I believe he will be a state witness. He's 78 years old, and he's not in good health. And remember, although he spent probably 30 years or 40 years in South Africa, he considers himself, he was never a citizen. Some people come to South Africa and they just become permanent residents. And that gives them an opportunity to live here, pay their taxes here, or what they're supposed to pay, I guess. And then when they feel like they've had enough, they can pack their bags and go. I've been here over 40 years and I became a citizen very quickly after arriving here, because I believe if a country is good enough to live in, it's good enough to be part of. But Mike Lomas never became a citizen. Now, if you're a non-citizen, you're treated slightly differently in terms of the Criminal Procedures Act and in terms of the methods used. Now, in my opinion, he didn't fight hard enough at the courts in the UK against extradition. He could have fought it a bit harder. So I suspect, and remember, at one stage, we had appointed an attorney to act for him in South Africa for the purpose of negotiating on his behalf for him to become a Section 204 witness, and probably not a Section 204 witness, but a 105A witness, which means he would have to plead guilty to certain offences, because you can't get indemnity from prosecution when you've committed serious crimes yourself. So the plan was that he should plead guilty to corruption and maybe get a suspended sentence, and in return, in terms of Section 105A, give evidence against the rest of the gang. And that was the original plan. And the negotiations started on that basis. And then about 3 months into the negotiations, we got a sudden instruction from him that he didn't want us to do any more work on the matter, and that he no longer wanted to cooperate with us, and that we should send all the documents and evidence that we had put together with his assistance to his attorney in the UK. So we sent all the stuff there, and we terminated the appointment of his attorney in South Africa. And I guess that was probably three something years ago. And after that, of course, I believe he probably at first thought he could get away with it. But then the extradition process started and he was released on bail. I think it was £250,000 of bail. But he'd already spent quite a bit of money at that stage here in South Africa. And I'm not suggesting it was the proceeds of crime. He had received salary from Trindade. He didn't appear to have benefited because remember, we saw his bank statements. He didn't appear, and he had a handsome leaving package from Group 5 when he left Group 5. So he was quite a wealthy man. He wasn't a poor man. Now, we couldn't see any evidence of him being in receipt of the proceeds of crime, save for the money laundering aspects in his account where he paid monies to Plakudi and he was paid that money back. So he was acting as a bagman in that respect. So I kind of feel we'll know what's going on with him when we find out what happens at his court appearance, because he's arrived back today. He'll either appear in court today or on Monday. You have to appear in court within 48 hours of being arrested. Well, his arrest will have taken place when he stepped off the plane. He can't be arrested overseas. He was already arrested overseas, but he wasn't arrested by South Africa. He was arrested by the UK authorities on an Interpol warrant. So his formal arrest will have taken place when he stepped off the plane, and then he has to appear in court either today or Monday. And then, in my opinion, three things can happen to him. Either he's released on bail, or he's detained without bail, or he's released into the witness protection program. Now, if he's released into the witness protection program, then you can be satisfied that he's going to be a safe witness against these other individuals. If he's released on bail, I would assume that he's going to be a state witness against these other individuals. So we'll only know when they make their next appearance in court. They tried very, very hard to get their case struck off, but they failed. So I guess now that Mike Lomas is home, if that's the right expression to use, and we know he's home because I was monitoring his flight. I think I sent you a picture of Flight Finder, and he was somewhere over Chad at 4 o'clock this morning, but his flight landed at, I think, 16 minutes past nine this morning. So he's well and truly on South African soil. I believe his wife is with him, and I believe that there was a medical practitioner on the plane as well, because Mike is not a fit and healthy person. He's 78.
What happens when you actually arrive? So you've been arrested by the British police. They've put you onto an aeroplane. Presumably you don't fly business class. You come to OR Tambo. You get off the plane. You get arrested by the South African police. And
well, remember,
then you go to jail.
You're already in the company of the South African police when you get on the plane, because you don't travel on the plane on your own. And as you rightly say, you don't travel business class. So the standard protocol for arrested persons that are being transported, what they call prisoner transportation, is that they sit with the police officers that are transporting them at the back of the plane, at the very back of the plane. And then what normally happens is the plane will be disembarked and they remain seated. And then when the plane has been disembarked, they will disembark. And there will be somebody waiting at OR Tambo. Now, the plane they came in was an A380. So it would have parked on A terminal and the plane would have been disembarked. And then they would have left. And the investigating officer either was on the plane with him, but there would have been other police officials. And once he steps off the plane, he's on international territory until he steps off the plane. But once he has his feet on South African soil, then they would formally touch him on the shoulder and say, "I'm arresting you," blah, blah, blah. Now he's formally under arrest in terms of the South African Criminal Procedures Act. Then the next process is they have to process him. They have to book him in I would have been booked in at the SAP 14 register at OR Tambo Airport. They have a sales there. You would have been put in the sales while it's booked in. And then they issue a thing called a live body receipt. And the police at OR Tambo would have issued that receipt to the investigating officer or whoever was there to collect him and take him away. And they would have taken him away. Now, I guess his next port of call would probably be Pretoria Central, or it could be Johannesburg Central. I don't really know, depending on how the docket is being managed. But it's certainly, I understand they appeared in the Palm Ridge Magistrates Court, but in the Commercial Crime Court, which is seated at the Palm Ridge Magistrates Court. So they would have probably taken him to book him in at Johannesburg Central. And then his court appearance would either be today or Monday, and then from there you will know what's going to happen. Now, he has to appear in court. There's no ways about that. And if they decide to keep him and detain him, it might appear that way in court, because if he's going into the witness protection program, that would be detention as well. There's two types of detention in the witness protection program. One of those types is you're detained as a prisoner, where you're actually under guard all the time, but you're still in the witness protection program. Now, since his wife is thought to have flown with him, I'm guessing that they probably have a little, what we call a safe house, somewhere for him to stay, which will be secure, until he appears in court to give evidence. And my imagination would be that at some point he will give evidence against these rascals, and then at some point he would plead guilty and be given a suspended sentence in terms of Section 105A. And then obviously he will go back to the UK and finish what's left of his life. But if he's an uncooperative person, which I doubt because he was extremely cooperative with us, if he's an uncooperative person, then I guess he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in a South African prison.
What's happened to the rest of the gang, as you call them, Trindade, Tlakudi, and the others who were involved in the plundering of Eskom?
So they're on bail, and they Tile is in the process of getting ready to proceed. Now, it may well be that with Lomas being home, the matter will be moved from the Commercial Crime Court to the High Court, because, or it may stay at the Commercial Crime Court. The thing about it is that there's a large sum of money involved. We're not talking about 5 rand here. We're talking about hundreds of millions of rand, over R1 billion. In my estimate, 1.4 billion rand. Now, if you've got corruption to the tune of 1.4 billion rand, you've got to be looking at somewhere between 20 years and life sentences for those individuals. So I think they're all facing very lengthy sentences. And with or without the evidence of Mike Lomas, they're open and shut case. The evidence is watertight.
And Trindade, Tony Trindade, I've seen your emails to him, and they're typical Paula Sullivan emails where you stir him up a little bit. His reaction to you, if I recall, was, and well, you've explained it now, was to counter everything that you'd said. But you did say in one of your affidavits that he does have a Portuguese passport. Has that been taken from him?
Yeah, his Portuguese passport has been, he's on bail and there's reporting conditions. So he can't leave the country. He's here now. He's stuck here. He used the proceeds of crime to hire lawyers to have a poke at me. I pointed out to them that they were being paid with the proceeds of crime. It didn't seem to bother them. But they failed in everything they tried to do. And after their failure, a week or 2 weeks after they failed, their clients were arrested. So who's paying them now? I don't know, because Trindade himself has been sequestrated. His companies have all been liquidated. On paper, he's a penniless man. But we all know that over a period of time, he moved millions and millions of rand out of the country. We know that because we've got evidence of that, and we gave that evidence to the liquidators. So what they're able to get back, but I'm pretty sure that Trindade has stuffed quite a few million rand. I'm just guessing at 100 million or maybe more will have gone to Portugal. How do we know that? Because he was money laundering between his companies, and he established overseas companies in places like Angola and Portugal, and he bought equipment from those companies and transferred money overseas, and that equipment was already here. He already owned it. So he was buying equipment that he already owned, and that was done for the purpose of money laundering. It's amazing how the banks assisted in all this money laundering. It's mind-blowing, in fact, that the banks in South Africa have been so readily able to assist in the money laundering of these criminals. And it leaves me no doubt that it's the conduct of the banks like that. And the lawyers, by the way, law firms that knowingly get paid with the proceeds of crime but are quite happy to receive that money and quite happy to perform services for that money. Those are the type of people that have got South Africa onto the grey list. And those are the type of people that I would also like to see going down with people like Trindade and Hlukadi. But, you know, unfortunately, it seems they get away with it. I wonder how many of them are now becoming compliant. We saw a recent report by the FIC that said only 38% or 40% of lawyers and estate agents and the category of people that have to issue compliance reports, only 40% of them have issued compliance reports, which means 60% of them are non-compliant, which is shocking. So this grey listing is here with us for a while to come still.
I hope that this is a reflection, though, that the country of no consequences is finally having consequences. From your own perspective, Paul, has there been any support from the South African police? We are aware that there are all kinds of obstacles that can get thrown in the way of a case like this through crooked cops. Have you encountered any of that?
No, I've encountered a good dose of, well, I can say, backbiting. Some of the cops involved in this process went out of their way to try and say that I hadn't been involved in the investigation, which is rubbish, of course, because I opened the docket back in 2019, and the evidence that I adduced is overwhelming. And it's ironic that all the people that I named in my docket are the people that are now on trial. And I mean, the fact that I flew up to London and persuaded Lomas to give a version of events under oath demonstrates that I was involved heavily in the investigation. But we had one of these cops who made the comment to Barry Roux, because we hired Barry Roux to negotiate the early stages of the negotiation of the Section 105A plea bargain agreement for Mike Lomas. And this cop at that meeting made the comment, well, just make sure Paul O'Sullivan's name doesn't appear on any of the documentation. So needless to say, I made that cop aware of the fact that I knew he'd made that comment and that I had no respect for him whatsoever. The cops have done a fair job. There's no doubt about it. The fact that they've been arrested, now it's not a police job, it's a prosecution job. And I'm satisfied that the NPA are on top of it. The police have done their work years ago. The police no longer have any work to do here, apart from bringing people before court. But the work that has to be done now is the NPA. And this project is in very capable hands. It's Andrea Johnson and the Investigative Directorate. This is one of their big projects. And I am satisfied that they've got the right people on the job and that we will see successful prosecution here and we will see these nasty characters going to prison.
And maybe some knock-on effects here. There were, within the affidavits, similar deals were done on Kalahari Manganese for a new smelter at Kucha. At Sishen South, the tenders were given to Trinidadi's company. The Kusili wastewater He seems like a really bad egg, and well done to Paul O'Sullivan for exposing all of this. He is with Forensics for Justice. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.